Carril 3.
I thought, well, it's not much good getting on the back there, so I crouched down at the front by the co-driver's hatch as best I could, and off we went. Although it was a clear, starry night, I don't really recall any moon out, and with the snow, it wasn't that thick, but it was reasonably light. Progress was slow because it was only one of these sort of dirt track roads. And Charlie Sadler was driver. He was driving on side lights only, and Mr. Alexander was getting instructions as best he could. We approached a burning village, and as we did so, figures sort of appeared again from the off side of the tank, I guess, as we were going south from the right, and they were calling, and Mr. Alexander said, "See where they are, Erica. I'll keep you covered with the Bren." I thought, well, that's all right for you, Governor. Anyway, we go over and see, and they were Royal Ulster Rifles, and one was wounded in the leg. And we put him on the back of the tank with a couple of the others. And then a message came through that supposedly on the radio, I don't know, that the hills were blocked. All right, Lieutenant Alexander said, we'll try the riverbed. Well, as I mentioned, we crossed this riverbed into the valley, and apparently there was a way out along it to the main supply route down into Saul. I think we went down there part of the way one morning, which could have been on the 2nd or January, couldn't have been the 3rd, to sort of look at it. And they thought, yeah, well, that could have been a way out. Presumably they'd realised that if trouble did occur, that they couldn't necessarily get out the way they came in. So we turned off and headed in the direction of the river, and now the battle was in full swing. And I remember seeing these red and green tracers arcing right up into the sky, and it looked all very pretty, sort of thing. A bit like fireworks, I suppose. And they were lighting everything up, and occasionally you would get a flare go up, whether it was one of ours or one of theirs, I don't know. You could see all the figures milling about. Chinese, when they attacked, they used to have lots of gongs and cymbals, whistles, and a lot of shouting. Obviously, one of their favourite ones was, "Don't shoot, Johnny, we're rocks," which was Republic of Korean troops. I suppose if one met that sort of situation head on, you would fire and ask questions afterwards. We arrived at the river and followed its course, but no good. Johnny Healy, the gunner, was firing the beezer as he went, but there were still lots of Chinese about, and we couldn't. I don't know quite why we stopped, but anyway, Mr. Alexander, I guess, decided that we couldn't get out that way, so we turned round and came back towards the burning village. And then we'd gone along a bit, and there was a lurch, and the tank sort of slid off a bit. Well, as I said, we were driving on side lights, so you couldn't see much. I don't know whether with hindsight, if one put one's headlights on, one would have got out, I don't know. But then, of course, it would have drawn more fire from the enemy. Jimmy Bates got out, I think it was, and he said the governor's had it. And apparently Mr. Alexander had been hit by a shrapnel from a mortar bomb. And him not being able to give the driver instructions which way to go, Charlie Sadler had slid off the road because they were up above the paddy fields, and it had partially pulled the track off. Jimmy Bates, yes, he got the MM apparently in the Second World War, putting his tank behind a haystack or something like that, they told us. He came out and said, "The governor's had it, lads, come on, bail out." Well, we bail out, and then within minutes a Royal Artillery tank came by. We explained the situation to him briefly, and he said, "All right, spike the gun, make your own way back." Well, by spiking the gun, usually you put a round down the barrel, pointing down, and one up the spout and fire, and one hits the other and it splits the barrel and makes the gun useless, you see. Well, that's all right for the RA tank guy, but we hadn't got time. Charlie Sadler and I went round to the back to get this wounded RUR man off. And in seconds, literally, it was, we were surrounded by Chinese. And I could see them coming, and then I moved round sort of to the front of the tank a bit more and thinking, well, I've got 6 bullets in my revolver. I'd got it in my hand, yeah, probably, I don't know. Possibly not, because of getting this other guy off the back of the tank. Well, with 6 bullets in a tank, in the revolver, you can't do much. even if you've got seven blokes and every bullet counts, you've got one left, you've got a hand-to-hand. So I thought, well, I don't know. I slipped the lanyard from round my neck and dropped it and the revolver into the paddy field. Then with hands high, I surrendered. Thinking, I suppose, really, it's no good having heroics. You're no John Wayne or any of these other film stars, and you're probably better a live coward than a dead hero.
Was this the first time you'd come face to face with
this? Was the first time we'd been in action, yeah. And we'd never, I mean, all right, we'd fired shells in the morning on the 2nd of January, the day before, and possibly that morning, but I mean, we'd never actually been in action against the Chinese as such. I mean, not close up or anything. I mean, we'd never been shot at then. That's probably the best way to put it.
What did they look like close up?
Chinese, I suppose. padded uniforms. And I'll swear from that day to this, I've said it many times, I'll guarantee it seemed like thousands of them, but it was probably only hundreds. And lots of them had got no small arms, either pistols, submachine guns, or rifles, or anything. And they were picking up ours as we dropped them. Well, I mean, as I said, with six bullets, and you've got a dozen Chinese there, you can't kill them all. One doesn't think at the time, oh, he's got a gun, he hasn't got a gun. You feel, well, what can I do? Not much. So up go your hands and surrenders. And the last 3 hours, they'd been a bit of a nightmare. I mean, I was 19 years old. I mean, I'd got no experience. I'd had a village education and a village upbringing, although I'd worked in Horsham for 3.5 years. I mean, it was a wholesale tobacconist assistant. So, I mean, I was naive. I'd got no experience, really, of life, let alone anything else. And this being the first action, you don't really know quite what's going to happen. I mean, you sort of say, well, you've given up, and like the bunny, you get put in the bag. You perhaps wonder whether one gets better at this fighting job as time goes on, but, I mean, for us, it wasn't to be. However, Charlie Sadler and the four blokes from the IUI, and we were lined up by the Chinese facing the wall of this Korean house, and your hands were above your head, and you thought, well, I don't know, is this the end of it? And previously, talking with the blokes, especially the reservists, you say, well, what's it like? Wonder what it's like getting shot, and that sort of thing. You see, you know you're going into action, or one hoped one was. And somebody said that it was like a burning sensation. Whether it is or not, I don't know. And you thought, well, is this the end of it? And Charlie said, don't worry, Bob, we'll be all right. And there were lots of Chinese voices, and then absolute chaos. Another Cromwell came by right next to the house, and he was firing with everything. And everybody scattered, Chinese, prisoners, the lot, and we all lay down in the paddy field in the snow. And again, momentarily, I thought, well, what if I lay here and pretend I'm dead? What'll happen? But you've got time to think, in a sense, but at the same time, you haven't, because I thought, well, I don't know. The others got up, Chinese and the other prisoners, so I'd got up.
Did this Cromwell seem to be hitting anybody?
It was difficult to say, because one didn't seem to stop and sort of find out, really. After he'd gone, you think perhaps, well, why lie down then, because it had gone, you see. I mean, it's like the shell that you hear, that's gone. It's the next one that you don't hear that's going to cause a problem. So whether one had stayed standing or not, I don't know whether it would have helped or not. But no, I don't know whether he was hitting anybody. They didn't line us up against the wall afterwards. They grouped us together and sort of motioned, I suppose, to sort of start walking. And one was seeing plenty of Chinese coming along wounded, and lots of these padded uniforms were burning. They do keep out the cold. We were to find later on, when they were issued to us as prisoners, they're very good for keeping out the cold, but it's filled with kapok and the least little spark and it'll start burning. Chaps who were smoking later in the winter time, when you were wearing your padded uniform, they were mostly rolled up cigarettes, and of course they fall apart easily as opposed to a tailor-made one, and you've got a lot of ash, hot ash, red ash, falling onto your trousers, if one smoked, of course. And there were many, many cases of the trousers burning, and some of them quite badly. It was all real chaos, but as I say, you could see these Chinese chaps having been wounded, but they didn't show us any animosity or anything at the time. Perhaps if one's friends had got shot, if the situation was reversed and some of your friends had got shot, you may sort of shoot one or two of them, I don't know. But they didn't show us any animosity at all.
Did that Cromwell escape, by the way?
No, none of them. Out of the 12 of Cooper Force, they were all knocked out for one reason or another. There were 5 to a crew, so that's, 60 bods, 30 from each regiment. Several got out. My parents wrote to Johnny Healy, and he wrote back to them to find out what had happened to me after I was reported missing. I'm not quite sure when it was. And he wrote back to them saying he didn't know what happened to Bob and Charlie after the tank they were running beside had stopped. Well, one can only assume, I've never met them afterwards, that they were running on one side of the Royal Artillery Cromwell that told us to spike the gun, and thought we were, Charlie and I, that is, were on the other side. But when it stopped, we weren't there. And, I mean, they didn't know what had happened to us, so whether they thought we'd been killed or what, I don't know. But, you see, we didn't run. We were getting the other guy, the wounded RUR chap, off of our tank. Several got killed. Out of our regiment, both the officers, Captain Ashley Cooper and Lieutenant Alexander, were killed. Captain Ashley Cooper got out of his tank, but he was last seen running up a hill with a Bren gun, and that is all we know. He apparently said to his crew, every man for himself, which is literally that. Make your own way back and best of luck. Lieutenant Alexander, he'd got the shrapnel in his head. Sergeant Ted Collins, he'd got killed. We don't know quite how. Incident there. Joe Dooley, I think he was his gunner. He was absolutely covered in blood on his tank suit. And Joe was taken prisoner. And the Chinese showed him a lot of concern as to whether he was wounded. With all this blood on him, they didn't know that it wasn't his, but he was all right. And Sergeant Jim Taylor, he got taken prisoner, and so did the two corporals. Out of the Royal Artillery, all 6 tanks got knocked out. Major Howe, I think, was killed, I'm not sure. Captain Gibbons was taken prisoner. I think he later died in the prisoner camp. And other than that, I don't know any of the other corporals or that, or who were their tank commanders, because they'd only joined us literally just a few days before we went into action. However, they sort of gathered us together and started to sort of move us back. And we were then meeting other crews from the tanks who had been taken prisoner. And one, Charlie Adams, I think his name was Charlie, although I've since learned it could have been Cyril. He was wounded in the hand, and he said when he surrendered, he put his hand up, and the bullet went right through his hand, in one side and out the other. And I put my field dressing on it and said, you know, what happened in Charlie, or Cyril, whatever his name was. And he said, oh, I think it was just a stray. It wasn't intentional. But unfortunately, he died later in the prison camp, I think of pneumonia, I'm not too sure. But as the minutes, I suppose, or not necessarily hours, ticked on, it became apparent that the whole lot of Cooper Force, that is, had been knocked out. And there were other POWs who kept joining us, and there was probably about 200, including Ulsters. During the early hours of that sort of January the 4th, we moved to a village away from the front line and kept passing hundreds and hundreds of Chinese going south. And I was, you know, still wearing my holster on my belt, and several of them kept stopping and pointing and presumably talking, you know, have you got your revolver in there? It was Chinese, so one couldn't understand it. And in the end, I took the blessed thing off and threw it away. And it wasn't any good to me anyway, but the belt might have come in handy. We arrived at a village, I suppose it was about dawn, and were searched again before being put into the Korean houses. They first moved out the Koreans, and this was a procedure that went through the entire march to Camp 5, which is right up on the border with Manchuria. You would get to your sort of overnight stop, and the Chinese could have been Koreans. No, it was Chinese to start with, then the Koreans took over afterwards. That they would move or go to the people, the Korean people, and say, right, presumably, we want a room, we've got so many prisoners. And one room was set aside for the prisoners. And can one imagine, really, what it would be like if you'd got these prisoners coming into your home? And there's nothing you could do about it. You've got to give them accommodation. Whether they were paid for it, I don't know. I've an idea they were. Something in the back of my mind tells me they were paid or paid later on sort of thing, given a chip perhaps or something like that, to say that they'd watered and fed these foreign devils, so to speak. One mind boggles, really, what one would think of it happening in one's own country, really. But, I mean, thank God they did, because otherwise it would have meant sleeping out in the open, wet or fine, whatever. And, I mean, it was a Korean winter, which is pretty rough, really.
Do you think they regarded you as foreign devils?
I don't know, really. I don't know. I think possibly some of them did, yes, they were anti-West, but then of course, I mean, they'd been communists since 1945, hadn't they? I mean, 5-6 years of communist rule. They were much better off under the communists, be they North Korean or Chinese, than they were under the feudal system, which is what they had experienced prior to the communists taking over, both in Korea and in China especially. I mean, the Chinese themselves weren't liberated from the feudal system, if you like, until 1949, wasn't it? When Mao Zedong threw out Chiang Kai-shek. So, I mean, they were infinitely better off. They put us in this village, and they searched us before putting in the houses, and put a guard outside, and it wasn't long before we got covered with lice, although some of them were, I suppose, got dirty quicker, if you like, and some were complaining about the lice before others. One can only put this down to the fact that there are some cleaner blokes in the British Army than others. I mean, one meets it all the time, really. You can sort of see it in Civvy Street. Some people don't seem to wash as often as others. But we soon got introduced to liberation. This is when we were in this very first Korean. It was sort of a compound in the houses, and they'd cleared the whole lot out, all the Koreans from it. You had sort of semicircle, perhaps, shape a bit U-shaped even, of several houses, perhaps three, and they cleared them all out, and we went in there, and it was just as they'd left it. Well, we were taken prisoner with virtually what we were standing up in. Well, now, it's quite surprising what some people will put in their pockets. I mean, later it comes out, some guy's got his knife, fork and spoon set. Others had got needles and thread, things like that. Well, a lot of us had got nothing. And there, in the corner, I suppose, or somewhere, were these brass spoons, which the Koreans use, basically, to eat with. They're very shallow, but one got on all right. Anyway, this was where we were sort of introduced to liberation, which is basically having something before it's lost. And this is where I liberated a brass spoon, which I used for the next 2.5 years, and I've still got it now. Our first meal arrived after probably a couple of hours, in which we were sort of left alone, wondering what was going to happen. And it was a bucket of rice with the husks still on. And you thought, well, God, is it going to be like this or what? But one was hungry because, I mean, we hadn't eaten since possibly the middle of the afternoon, of the third, and this was the morning of the fourth. So, I mean, time was getting on. One doesn't think of eating when you're fighting, but, you know, afterwards you begin to think, well, it's time we had something inside us. And one guy pulled out a tin of compote jam. And I say, it's surprising what these chaps put in their pockets. But that was opened, and we all had these little can openers. They come with the compote packs, and they're just a little piece of flat metal with a hook-shaped swivel on it, and it just sort of swivels open, and you put it in the can and give it a twist. So very, very good, very an ingenious method then. I never heard of one breaking at all. You can get them in Civvy Street, but I think they're few and far between. But I suppose you probably had two or three in every compo pack that one was issued with. So, I mean, naturally they went in your pocket to open the tins when one wanted them, not necessarily at the meal times, but I mean, if you wanted a bar of chocolate like that, that was all canned, you see, and I think you've got cans of sweets as well, so you had one of these can openers in your pocket, and this guy got a tin of compo jam, so that went in with it. A lot of the chaps here had their personal effects taken from them. I didn't, but I do remember some of them taking them, and one Chinese soldier, he wanted the cat badge, but he didn't press it, and I said, no, you can't have it, because he wasn't an 8th Hussar, so he wasn't entitled to wear it, sort of thing. I think I've still got that one now. Not too sure. I'm pretty sure it stayed with me. This is sort of the start of being a POW, and there's no doubt about it. It brings out the best and the worst in men. Most of them shared, especially the smokers. It is a drug, there's no doubt about it. I don't myself, so one was able to barter with one's tobacco ration, which one we received later as prisoners. They shared, and there's one guy, he kept pulling out cigarettes, tailor-made, after everybody else had finished, and it suddenly sinks on some of them, well, what's he doing, where's he getting them from? So they grab hold of him and have a look in his overcoat pocket, and he's got a tin of 50 in there, and what he's doing is pulling one up, still in his pocket, breaking it in half, and pretending he's only got half of one left, you see. So, of course, that was shared round. And I suppose they must have asked the Chinese for roll-ups, because they had tobacco, and the Koreans had tobacco, and they would give you a roll, or give the smokers a roll, if you like. They didn't fraternise too much, but they weren't too anti-Western, shall I say. Some were probably more so than others. They probably gave us some tobacco, because I can remember Tambi paper, which is tobacco paper. Tambi, presumably, I don't know if it's Chinese or Korean, is the word for tobacco. Tambi paper was always short. You could never find enough paper for roll-ups. Several chaps were taken prisoner with their Bibles, and Charlie Adams, as we should call him, who was shot in the hand, he had his, and he used to read it every day, quite religiously. Again, presumably he smoked, because I can recall in the end his Bible started to go. And of course, Bibles and prayer books are very thin paper, so it makes nice roll-up paper sort of thing. A bit uneventful there. We stayed in this little village, I suppose, for 2 or 3 days. And during the day, they put us up in the hills. And now it's January, so January weather, northern hemisphere, is getting pretty cold. And it was bitterly cold. Well, they told us they were putting us up in the hills in case the Americans came over and did their bombing and strafing. Well, they couldn't call it bombing. It was bombings because of their pronunciation. And all we were in was a hide, basically, I suppose one can best describe it, of straw. And this held perhaps, I can't remember whether they were stooks of straw, like one used to see years ago in the fields in England, or whether they were the sort of bale tub. Probably they were more like the stooks one used to see. And you'd get probably 4, half a dozen blokes in each one. And you'd stay there all day long, from having had breakfast, possibly about dawn, I suppose, until perhaps 4 o'clock when it was getting dark in the afternoon. Yeah, you must have been allowed to get out to relieve yourself, but possibly only one at a time, and it was so cold. And there was just absolutely nothing to do. Thankfully, the Americans didn't come over with their trigger-happy pilots. We just used to sit there talking and, I suppose, pulling the generals about as to why we got into such a situation, how the Americans had let everybody down again and again, sort of thing.
So that's who you threw the blame on?
Basically, for getting taken prisoner, because they were on the left flank facing, as we were facing, the Chinese positions, and when the withdrawal came, they'd gone. And the Chinese definitely came round from the left, as opposed to the right, where the Northumberland Fusiliers were. And the history books will probably put it in more detail. We stayed there, I suppose, for a few days. Then we went to a schoolhouse. And that was terrible, that was it. It was so bitterly cold, but I'm pretty sure it was sort of a collecting area, I suppose. And there were quite a lot of us then. I have an idea, that's when some of the Americans joined us. I can't really recall, but I can remember we were in this big school room, and a lot of us then, the place was absolutely packed, the corridors and the rooms. We slept in a big circle, and we always reckoned it was better if you took your boots off at night so as they could air and perhaps dry out a bit, you see, because being the cold, one got hot walking and that sort of thing, and they would get sweaty. And we used our boots for pillows and all lay like spoons trying to keep warm, because there was absolutely no heat at all. Temperature-wise, golly, I don't know. I think there have been reports of it being sort of minus 50 or something quite absolutely ridiculous. But however, it was cold, and I think, quite unashamedly, some of us, we cried with the cold, because it was so cold, and life seemed so hopeless then. We were still relatively fit. I hadn't been to the toilet at all. I think we were there, and the other village, about a week before we started on the march. And I can remember saying to one of the chaps, I haven't been to the toilet for, you know, about a week now. He said, well, it's not unnatural if you think of your diet being basically rice or grain sort of thing now, and much lighter than a Western food, so your stomach's got to become accustomed to it. One had urinated, obviously, that sort of thing. I mean, I hadn't been to the toilet